This recording is a production of Faith Builders Resource Group. This presentation was recorded at Teachers Week 2023, held at Faith Builders on August 1 to 4.
Okay, well, I am Jeremy Souter from Lancaster. I teach at Sunlight School. I'm the administrator there, and for most of my years I taught predominantly in grades 7 and 8 and some high school classes. But this year we have a teacher coming full-time to teach grades 7 and 8, so I'll mostly be doing high school classes for the first time. So I taught around the world in 80 days, I don't know how many times, to grades 7 and 8, so I chose that one as something that I've done to use as an example today. But that will just be part of the workshop. Or a breakout for the beginning. I plan to spend a lot of time on philosophy of imaginative stories or imagination to argue for why imaginative stories are valuable. And then we'll finish up with more practical, as you can see on the back side of your handout. So your handout is designed as an outline for the presentation that you can take notes as you see fit. That'll be the outline that I'm following. So we'll start with a story, since we're talking about stories. One time, there was a woodcutter who lived in a village that depended on wood for their income, dependent on the forest for their livelihood. And one day he was out cutting wood with his axe, and his axe slipped and went into the river. Since he depended on the axe for his livelihood, he sat down and wept. Soon, the river god came out of the river and said, "Why are you weeping?" He said, "I'm a poor man, and I have lost my axe, and I have no way to provide for my family." The water god listened and then plunged into the river and soon came out holding a golden axe. "Is this your axe?" he asked the woodcutter. The woodcutter examined the golden axe and said, "No, that's not mine." Setting the axe aside, the river god plunged back into the river. And a bit later came up holding a silver axe. "Is this your axe?" "No," said the woodcutter, "that's not my axe. I am a poor woodcutter. How can I own a gold or silver axe? I have only an iron axe." The water god went into the river again, and this time he came back with the iron axe of the woodcutter. When the woodcutter saw his axe, he became very happy. He showed his gratefulness and respect to the river god, and seeing the honesty of the woodcutter, the river god gave him the gold and silver axe as a gift along with his original iron axe. Take a moment to reflect. You could write something down if you'd like, or just reflect on that story. How does it speak to you? So as you read imaginative stories with your students, you can draw them out, and you'll be amazed what observations they come up with about real life, even though the story isn't real. It still illustrates one main thing that every story has: a problem, right? And isn't there one main problem in life? We live in a fallen world, and this creates a problem for us that may come in many different forms. What would you say is the problem in the world?
Sin.
Sin. And sin leads to death. And so we all face death and sin, and there are many different axes, many routes up the mountain, but only one good outcome to overcome sin and death. What is the solution? What would you say the solution is to life?
Salvation.
Salvation.
Redemption.
Redemption. Jesus. Love. Good. So there is, even as we explore imaginative stories, there is only one true story, the gospel, the story of the world. And all Hollywood stories or other made-up stories are variations on that. And perhaps even a counterfeit, variations or counterfeits of the true story. And as we examine stories, we find that the stories we wish were true reveal a void that can only be filled by the one story that is true. And so most stories search for a redemption, a solution to the problem. You take a series like the Bobbsey twins going on an adventure, you can always have another one. You just have to create another problem. The mystery stories, you know, what's the mystery this time? You just create another problem to solve. So it is common sense, and rightfully so, to protect children from evil, but many wish to keep the dark side of man from children, not realizing that the dark side is in them already and is pursuing them. So to keep a child away from a story that has evil in it will not protect the child, because we all live with a fallen sin nature, and the evil is within us waiting to devour. And as they read stories that grapple between good and evil, they can wrestle, and sometimes even subconsciously, they're not always realizing what's going on, but it helps them wrestle with good and evil in their lives, inside of themselves. Moving on to parables, another parable spake he unto them. The kingdom of heaven is like unto leaven, which a woman took and hid in 3 measures of meal, till the whole was leavened. All these things spake Jesus unto the multitude in parables, and without a parable spake he not unto them. That it might be fulfilled which was spoken by the prophet, saying, I will open my mouth in parables, I will utter things which have been kept secret from the foundation of the world. And I'd like to give you a glimpse here that as teachers, our job is to unlock the secrets of the universe for our students, the things that have been kept secret from the foundation of the world. Not that we can do all of that on our own, but as we explore science and as we explore story, we are giving our children a glimpse of what God has put into the fabric of the universe, and unlocking, giving our children a vision of that. And that can happen through science and nature, and that can happen through story. And story has the value of being able to touch people internally in ways that physical things don't. So Jesus compared himself to a chicken. Can you think of a reference? The coming of the kingdom to a robber breaking into your house. God's message of hope to an uncorked bottle of wine. And prayer to a nagging neighbor hungry for a sandwich at midnight. So according to Jesus, we can learn about God's kingdom from eccentric landowners, dishonest managers, a warm loaf of bread, a field full of weeds, and a child tugging at your legs asking you to come out and play. So, is God a chicken?
Probably not.
There are multiple layers there. So comparing himself to a chicken, okay, it does not mean... So why would he do that?
Well, he's a metaphysical being, and it's hard for us to understand what he actually is, so he gives us concrete examples of what he is and how he acts.
Good. And so some of the most true and deepest realities in life that we're trying to get at are metaphysical, and you know, we can't see them. So it's great to talk about love, sacrifice, honesty, diligence. Those sound like good things, but what do they mean? So when children see them in action, in story form, this enfleshes the gospel and allows them to connect with it. We are made in the image of God. So we can take things better from animals in some way. You know, think of when Nathan came to David and told him a story about the man and his poor little sheep. And you are the man. So sometimes we can take things better from animals than someone telling us to our face, you know, you're eating like a pig. So stories can allow us to see ourselves. So moving on to imagination, we are made in the image of God. And this allows us to imagine. So when we think about imagination, I don't know what comes to your mind. Good, is it good, bad, evil, neutral? Anybody have thoughts there about what comes to your mind with imagination? Does that excite you or scare you? Or
I'm not quite sure. Creativity.
Is possible.
Creation.
Yes. So here's a definition for imagination in case you want one. The process of bringing to mind things that are not present to our senses. The process of bringing to mind things that are not present to our senses. So I can look out the window and see a mother in a stroller. I can see that. It's to my senses. But we can also imagine that we're in Oregon on the side of that 200-foot cliff that we heard about this morning. So Jonathan was getting us to use our imaginations this morning to follow him to Oregon. So bringing things not present to our senses. So all children have an imagination, and they can use it for good or evil, just like many other things in life. An imagination can be captured by the devil, or it can be captured by the spirit. And how you use your imagination can vary. So it could be both good and evil, but it is not neutral, because your imagination is like your heart, can be captured one way or the other. So we are made in the image of God, and this gives us the ability to imagine. I don't know, do animals have an ability to imagine? Nuts that have not yet been gathered, or are they just following instinct? But I think because we're made in the image of God, this gives us a special capacity to imagine and create. We are co-creators with him then, in using his universe to imagine and create things. So I'd like to move on to three values that imagination develops. Perspective, discernment, and vision there, you can see on your handout. First of all, perspective is the way things are. You are being shaped by the stories you experience. Perspective is how we view the world, and imagination gives us the gift of being able to leave the classroom or our present location and go to Oregon, the Grand Canyon, Mount Everest, etc., and learn something about the world and then come back to where we are. And in the process, we examine ourselves and then return to reality. And so even though you cannot climb Mount Everest yourself, you can go there through somebody else's story and imagine their trials and tribulations that built their life in a stronger way than it is you. But you can still be challenged in smaller ways than they were, come back to your reality and gain a new perspective on your life. So one value of imagination is to build perspective. Here's a saying for you to consider. A fact is just a fact until put into a story. So if you take a random fact, what does this mean? And even I was in Mr. Brubaker's science breakout yesterday morning, and he was encouraging us to, when talking about a scientific fact or principle, to one way to bring it to the students is to couch it in story. The students are more likely to not just remember it, but to be able to identify where it fits into the world. In fact, a lot of brain research in recent times would argue that we think in terms of story. That our brain is not as much of a raw machine in some ways as you might imagine, that it just puts facts in there and spins them around, but that when your brain gets a new fact, it says, you know, where does this belong? What can I associate it with in a sense of story? So story has a value in giving us perspective and being able to shelve our facts somewhere. second value of imagination is discernment. Discernment about the way things are going to be. When we leave in our imagination and go to our imaginary place, when we come back, we can be inspired to do better. Here, in the here and now, maybe even in my homework, more inspired than through story than the teacher just telling me, you should work harder and pay attention. We also have a whole picture illustrated in a story. You can, for instance, run through a person's whole life, and it takes you a whole life to live your whole life. So the value of story is getting to see that big picture with the outcome, et cetera, and then coming back and examining your life and saying, you know, if I don't want to end up there, maybe I should adjust some things. In a similar way, stories allow us to see sin develop and cause death. As we were just saying a minute ago, what is the main problem in life? In the story, we can watch a character follow the path of sin, say in Macbeth or something like that, and we can see how this ends up and then realize we don't want to follow that path. And stories can give us the discernment that evil is counterfeit and yet appealing. And disobedience can then in some ways seem ludicrous if we experience fulfillment. So you're facing a temptation in your life and it feels easiest to disobey, and then you go examine a story in which the character runs through what will happen if they're disobedient, and you're telling the character in the story, don't do it, don't do it, I wouldn't do that. And then you come back to your life and realize, yeah, maybe I do that. And you can gain more discernment, maybe in something you already know in your life, through imagination. And third, imagination develops vision, the way things ought to be, reality beyond the seen. For instance, faith in Hebrews is the substance of things hoped for, the evidence of things not seen. So a deep belief I have, I put faith in parentheses there for you, is that imagination is crucial to our ability to develop faith. So as Christians, we talk about faith. This is a great thing you should have. How do you develop faith? Well, through experiences, there may be multiple ways to develop faith, but I would argue that you are using your imagination, the evidence of things not seen. And so when we stretch children's imaginations in good ways, we're actually stretching or building their capacity to build faith and imagine, like I said, vision is the way things ought to be. Imagine the way things ought to be when heaven and earth will be one, when there will be no tears, when things will be back the way they should be in the new heavens and the new earth. That is a reality that we should be living in that drives our lives today. And imagination can help our students vision the way things ought to be. So again, there's three things: perspective, discernment, and vision. Perspective is the way things are. They can learn more about how the world actually operates. Number two, discernment, the way things are going to be. And number three, vision, the way things ought to be. Moving on to what do we teach? So when you're teaching literature or English, whatever you might be using a story like this, what are you trying to teach? Some of the workshops here are geared towards K-2, phonics, decoding, and when you're teaching reading at those levels, the main thing is to learn how to read, to decode fluency. And then as you get to upper grades, I'm aiming this towards middle grades or upper grades, I used Around the World in 80 Days in grades 7 and 8, but it could go either way probably. You're still building fluency. Maybe some students aren't reading real well, But what else are you trying to teach besides just decoding English? Here are three suggestions for you: meaning, gospel, and culture. Consider this. Arguably, our greatest problem is to find meaning in our lives. I know it's sin, but since we have sin, this creates this problem, finding meaning in our lives. This is arguably the most important and most difficult task in raising and teaching children. Imaginative stories start where children are and provide solutions to difficulties. What children at a young age do not need are proverbs stuffed down their throat that they don't understand. So there's nothing wrong with reciting proverbs to encourage them, but when children are very young, they cannot process. You cannot sit down and preach them a sermon and think logically. The logical thinking hasn't developed yet at a young age, so I'm not sure what all range we have in here of who you're teaching, but thinking of imaginative stories, especially for young children, they start where children are and provide solutions to difficulties that, as I said earlier, they can process internally and not even realize that they're processing it. So when they're reading Jack and the Beanstalk, they might be processing things inside that they don't even know they're processing. And if you would actually try to explain to them, now this is what's happening, it would possibly lose the meaning or diminish the effect on them. So we're trying to teach meaning, good, evil, discernment, and I would argue that story is a good way to teach meaning, which is one of the hardest things to teach. Under gospel, I touched on this earlier, I guess, that stories can in a sense be gospel enfleshed. So if Jesus came here and talked to us today, what would he say? Well, we can look at the Gospels to see some of what he said, and there is the Sermon on the Mount. But there's also a lot of parables, and with what I read earlier, he told lots of stories which enflesh the Gospel, give us examples of flesh, of success and failure in the flesh. And this is a privilege that we have in our private schools to teach the Gospel in ways that you can't at the public school. Because in a lot of cases, you can't even mention the name of Jesus or encourage that as a way for the children to follow. And then finally, culture. Imaginative places are microcosms of life, family, world, kingdom. So what is the kingdom of God? Well, when Jesus compares it to a mustard seed, he's putting it down to a microcosm. Not sure if you know what I mean by a microcosm, but just a small reality that illustrates the bigger whole is how I'm using it here. So students can learn things about culture by examining these imaginative stories, relationships with parents, communities, community or value of community, things we're trying to teach them as they wrestle with those realities in the stories. It's building their understanding of culture. And then number four, why use trade books? Well, I would argue that the difference could be between giving them a balanced meal or, it's a more balanced meal. There's a question between, do you use lots of short stories like an anthology, so they're constantly having short stories, or do you use all books where it takes several weeks to go through a book, so then they never have all of these short stories? So I advocate for a compromise, although I know some people may use one or the other. So we generally use some type of anthology in our literature classes and then put a book or two in or three every year, really depending what the teacher has the passion and vision for. Another reason to use trade books is to develop larger, fuller picture, see the characters developed. So in a short story, you just get a glimpse into someone's life or situation, and in a full novel, you get a chance to see the character develop, make the wrong choice, and no, they shouldn't do that, and see the outcome and see the character change. And you can sustain questions from day to day and come back to those questions. And then finally, they are, in a sense, more real life to the student. There's something about a textbook that is automatically fake. It's sort of the library book versus the school book. So the students might enjoy reading library books, but not like literature class, because they have this mindset that in literature class, we pull these boring big fat books off the shelf and they have lots of stories in them, and then we have to answer questions about them. But I enjoy reading from the library. And so if you can challenge their world and say, you know, Around the World in 80 Days over here, that's an interesting book, we're going to take that and actually put it into our class, it can excite them in a new way, because it's, this is just a real book off the shelf that we're actually using in school, and it doesn't build up that dichotomy as much between fun books and school books. So something else to consider. Moving on now to the back side of your handout, how to use trade books. A few points and then we'll look at some examples. First of all, be inspired. Inspiration is really being filled with the Spirit. If you look at the root of the word enthusiasm, it is entheos, being filled with God. So be excited about not just the story, but about these things that I've been talking about the gospel, about life. And if you're enthused about your story, you will find ways to bring out these life realities in the story to your students. So be excited. Research the story. Own the story. If you're going to use this book in class, make sure you read through it ahead of time if you haven't read it. Become familiar with it yourself. You don't necessarily have to quote paragraphs like we heard this morning, but you should know what's coming, not be in for a surprise yourself. Don't just pull a book off the shelf and decide to do it. Research it, decide if it's a good one, talk to some other teachers, and know that it's worthwhile. Own the story. You could ask them for ideas. And then some ideas on reading together. Definitely read some portions out loud, on the floor, outside. Maybe if you only have one copy of the book, there are ways to do that out loud. You could have the students read a chapter. If you only have one copy of the book, you could have a student take the book home and read the chapter for tomorrow and become an authority on that chapter, and they could each take a turn doing that. Plus, it would have to be read to the rest of the class then. For most of the times we do this, we buy multiple copies of the book if that's in your budget, so that each student has their own, and so then they're usually assigned to read it personally, plus some in class. And there's nothing, if a good book is worth reading, it's worth reading twice. So there's nothing wrong with having them read something the night before and then rereading the passage out loud together as a class. It's makes the experience come alive in the moment. If it's a very fun passage, they'll enjoy that. They could read silently some as homework, round robin. You can have them read until a student makes a mistake and then the next student picks up. You can have them read by character. So there are several different characters in this story and they could be assigned, almost like dramatizing it. You could listen sometimes. You could listen to a recording that you access somehow, especially maybe for a struggling reader. I've given them their playaways or a CD version of the book for someone who can't read at the pace I'm expecting the class to keep up to. They can listen to it, that way they can still engage in the discussion tomorrow in class. And don't forget to, if you're rereading fun parts together, emphasize enunciation and reading to match the tone so that you're getting them to dramatize or act out the way it's being portrayed in the story to make it come alive. So Next, I'd like to look at a couple examples from around the world in 80 days. How many of you have read this book? Okay, a couple of you. So this was written by Jules Verne, for those of you that may not be familiar. He wrote it in the 1800s at a time when things were changing in the world. The world was getting smaller. And so what the novel is based on, whether you can get around the world in 80 days by steam ship and steam train and other unique forms of transportation, what that's based on was actually, in a sense, happening at the time. He was living in an era when the Transcontinental Railroad in America had just recently been completed, and there was a railroad across India, the Suez Canal had recently been finished. So he was living in an era when times were changing, and he was inspired to wonder, how fast could somebody go around the world? So he wrote an imaginative story about it. First of all, some themes. I'll read a little bit here. So Fogg is a rich Englishman, and his last servant, he's the main character in the story, who takes on the challenge to go around the world in 80 days. His last servant was dismissed for bringing shaving water 2 degrees too cold. So Passepartout shows up and is told his watch is 4 minutes off. So right away we know Fogg is an exact eccentric character. I'll read some of his schedule here. The servant, Passepartout, suddenly observed hung over the clock a card which upon inspection proved to be a program of the daily routine of the house. It comprised all that was required of the servant from 8 a.m, exactly at which hour Phileas Fogg rose, till 11:30, when he left the house for the Reform Club. All the details of service, the tea and toast at 8:23, the shaving water at 9:37, and the toilet at 10:20. You might have to explain to your modern students what a toilet is in this usage. Everything was regulated and foreseen that was to be done from 11:30 a.m. till midnight, the hour at which the methodical gentleman retired. Mr. Fogg's wardrobe was amply supplied and in the best taste. Each pair of trousers, coat, and vest bore a number indicating the time of year and season at which they were in turn to be laid out for wearing, and the same system was applied to the master's shoes. In short, the house, which must have been the very temple of disorder and unrest under the illustrious but dissipated Sheridan, was coziness, comfort, and method idealized. There was no study or books, which would have been useless to Mr. Fogg, for at the Reform, there were 2 libraries. So, in the beginning, we set the stage that this is a rich, eccentric gentleman who spends all his day at the Reform Club. We're not sure how he made his money, but he has lots of money, and so he just goes to the club every day. So there are interesting things to explore here about how he values time. And I'm actually going to jump toward to the end of the book, where he arrives on time, to continue on this theme of time. They're wondering whether he's going to make it back in 80 days. Now, 80 days isn't about 80 days. It is 80 days to the exact. It was quarter of nine was the time that he had left. So they're waiting for him to come. What time did the last train arrive from Liverpool? Asked Thomas Flanagan. At 7:23, replied Gauthier. And the next does not arrive till 12:10. Well, gentlemen, returned Andrew Stewart, if Phileas Fogg had come in the 7:23 train, he would have got here by this time. We can therefore regard the bet as won. Wait, don't let us be too hasty, replied Samuel Flanagan. You know Mr. Fogg is very eccentric. His punctuality is well known. He never arrives too soon or too late, and I should not be surprised if he appeared before us at the last minute. Why, said Andrew, if I should see him, I should not believe it was he. The fact is, resumed Thomas, Mr. Fogg's project was absurdly foolish. Whatever his punctuality, he could not prevent the delays which were certain to occur, and a delay of only 2 or 3 days would be fatal to his tour. Observe, too, added John Sullivan, that we have received no intelligence from him, though there are telegraphic lines all along his route. He has lost, gentlemen, said Andrew Stewart. He has 100 times lost. And so they decide, I'll skip a little bit as they're continuing to discuss. At this moment, the hands of the clock pointed to 20 minutes to 9. 5 minutes more, said Andrew. The five gentlemen looked at each other. Their anxiety was becoming intense, but not wishing to betray it, they readily assented to Mr. Flalentine's proposal of a rubber. I wouldn't give up my 4,000 of the bet, said Andrew Stewart, for 3,999. The clock indicated 18 minutes to 9. The players took up their cards, but could not keep their eyes off the clock. 17 minutes to 9, said Thomas as he cut the cards which Ralph handed to him. Then there was a moment of silence. The great saloon was perfectly quiet, but the murmurs of the crowd outside were heard, with now and then a shrill cry. The pendulum beat the seconds, which each player eagerly counted as he listened with mathematical regularity. 16 minutes to 9, said John Sullivan in a voice which betrayed his emotion. 1 minute more and the wager would be won. Andrew and the partner suspended their game. They left their cards and counted the seconds. At the 40th second, nothing. At the 50th, still nothing. At the 55th, a loud cry was heard in the street, followed by applause, hurrahs, and some fierce growls. The players rose from their seats. At the 57th second, the door of the saloon opened, and the pendulum had not beat the 60th second when Phileas Fogg appeared, followed by an excited crowd who had forced their way through the club doors, and in his calm voice said, "Here I am, gentlemen." So, the $20,000 bet was won down to the 57th second, not yet beating the 60th. And so I haven't ruined the book for you because there are many other exciting adventures and even a story about why he was so late to the last second. There's plenty for you to still discover in the book. So the most important theme in this book is time. Fogg's wager was a race against time, and his adventures illustrate repeatedly that time is fickle and either works for or against them. In many cases, time foils their plans, delays build up, ships and trains leave without them. In the end, though, time turns out to be what wins Fogg his bet, since they crossed a day when they gained a day when crossing the international dateline. So the ultimate message is no one can control time, and humans are at its mercy. So this novel, as I said, was written at a time when time seemed to be changing. You could go around the world faster than you could before. So there are many real things for students to learn from this book about time, whether it is the constant race we all have against time, or whether it is geographical realities of following his route around the world. A lot of times I would have students create a map or research or map his journey somehow of where he was going. So what could be done with exploring that theme from time? You could have discussion with your students, writing assignments, whether an essay or simple question prompts. For instance, why do some people seem to care more about punctuality than others? So since Fogg is such a eccentric, punctual person, you can easily have arguments with 7th and 8th graders, as you might know. It doesn't take much to get this started. Is it important to be on time? Is that a time constant for all places and people? So you could discuss it or have them write about that. Should we all be punctual? Is Mr. Fogg too time conscious? Is he just too crazy? Another theme to explore could be honor. Though he has the opportunity to double his fortune, Fogg's motivation to embark on such a crazy adventure has little to do with money. Instead, he wants to preserve his honor and prove to the gentlemen of his club that he can do what he sets out to do. In fact, Fogg spends nearly all of his money along the way. showing that riches are not what he's truly out for. So the irony is he had about 20,000 net worth, and so that's what he put up for the wager. He took it with him in a carpet bag, spent it all to get around the world, and since he won the wager, he got it back, but he didn't gain any more. So for Phileas Fogg, honor is more important than money. And Jules Verne, our author, may be poking fun here at the English honor that was very important in English society. For instance, Fogg is also determined to fight a duel, which got interrupted by an Indian raid, to protect his honor after almost getting punched at a political rally in San Francisco, which necessitated a visit to the tailor, which shows English dress codes. Again, it's interesting to imagine what it was like for a gentleman traveling years ago. You know, jeans and t-shirt might be enough now, but no, he needed his suit, whether he was on a train or the back of an elephant. And so after things got a little riled up there, the political demonstration in San Francisco, which is punching fun at the Americans and how wild and rowdy they get with their democratic processes, he had to go to the tailors to get his suit straightened out. And a gentleman almost got punched. And so that was enough to almost have a duel, or to have a duel then, which didn't come out. So this could prompt discussion and writing about what is the difference between honor and pride. Was he protecting his pride here by threatening to have a duel, by taking the wager, by keeping his clothes tidy and clean? Is it good to be proud? Is it ever good to be proud? Is pride always bad? Is it good to be honorable? What's the difference between the two? Romans 12:10 tells us to honor one another. So honor one another. So how do you honor others? Should you honor yourself? So again, I might do that through discussion or assigning a writing piece after we read about an episode like that, or some of both. Maybe have a bit of class discussion to spark something and then give an assignment and say, well, write more about that for tomorrow. Another theme in this book is imperialism. Written in the 19th century at the height of the British colonization, this novel rings with the themes of imperialism, and this, you may have heard the saying that the sun never set on the British Empire because it reached all around the world. And it's somewhat mind-boggling to us today to imagine that influence. So you talk about this in history class, the British conquered a lot of the world, but reading a novel like this can put some flesh to it for them. Even though the novel itself isn't true, Verne is, Mark Twain said, truth is stranger than fiction. Fiction, after all, has to stick to possibilities. But, I don't know, everything's possible in here. But he's still basing his story on the world at the time. And so he's basing it on the realities of the British Empire, even though Fogg is a fictional character in the British Empire. So a lot of the places Fogg goes are British-owned. Places like, the Suez Canal was for a while, India, Hong Kong. And as he goes there, you see the effects of colonization mixed in with native cultures and customs. So the students will learn about native Indian customs of sati, burning the widow on the funeral pyre. And the Fogg comes across this, and that's all I'll say about that. But, you know, Fogg is a very, well, it's not quite all I'll say. Fogg is a very mechanical man, not given to emotion. So when you come across, as a British honorable gentleman, when you come across a lady being burned alive, what do you do as an honorable gentleman? When, especially when your honor is split, okay, do we save a lady or do we keep the bet, right? We have to win the wager to save our honor, but would it also be honorable to save the lady? So that's a interesting dilemma in the book. So back to British Empire. So that was a custom that the British were trying to outlaw in India, but it was an Indian custom, something that's mentioned in the history book, but fleshing it out here gives the students a whole another understanding of it. So I'll read one section about meeting the consul when they get to India. So Fogg wants to get his passport stamped, get a visa to prove that he traveled here. He's an honorable gentleman, so he has to prove to win his wager that he actually went around the world and didn't just go hide in the closet and come back. So he wants to get this stamp and visa. The consul took the document and carefully read it, whilst Fix observed, or rather devoured, the stranger with his eyes from a corner of the room.
"You are Phileas Fogg?"
said the consul after reading the passport. "I am."
"And this man is your servant?"
"He is, a Frenchman named Passepartout."
"You are from London?"
"Yes."
"And you are going?"
"To Bombay."
"Very good, sir. You know that a visa is useless and that no passport is required?"
"I know it, sir," replied Phileas Fogg, "but I wish to prove by your visa that I came by Suez."
"Very well, sir."
The consul proceeded to sign and date the passport, after which he added his official seal. Mr. Fogg paid the customary fee, coldly bowed, and went out, followed by his servant. So there's a detective following Fogg who suspects him of a crime, and that's a whole other plot, subplot, or storyline that's in the book that I'm not mentioning much about today, but that played in there with the detective watching him. So in little episodes like this, the students learn that the British Empire had a huge mark on the world, so they could research the British Empire holdings, illustrate a map, or do a little bit of research on the side there to learn more about imperialism and find out, is this actually true, that if you were a British citizen, you didn't have to get your passport stamped. Another theme we could bring out and discuss is personality. Something that we all have, and back to themes I talked about at the beginning, we're trying to develop gospel and meaning and good personality in our students, so we can often learn how to build our personalities by studying others. So Fogg, our main character, is cold, calculated, quiet, doesn't say more than he has to, and shows perseverance because he sticks at his journey no matter what. Passepartout, his new servant, who we're introduced to in the beginning of the book, is conveniently created by our author to be the opposite. Brash, talkative, and risk-taker. In fact, he used to work in the circus and do the high ropes and things like that. So he complements Fogg's personality in unexpected ways. He makes mistakes that Fogg saves him from, and yet ends up saving the day in the end of the book, so they end up saving each other. And they're aware of this in some ways in the book, that they complement each other. So in approximately 100 words, compare and contrast the personalities of Mr. Fogg and Passepartout, and then make a prediction on how well or how long they will fit or work together. So there would be ways to maybe create charts. Maybe you've seen a Venn diagram or a T-chart. They could, as you go through the story, again, an advantage of multiple days is these characters are changing, they're learning more about the personalities, so they could be tracking their personalities, or this could just be an assignment where they write about it. Or they could act out a contrasting scene for the enjoyment of seeing how different they are. And one of the students could be Mr. Fogg, and one could be Passepartout, and they're so different from each other, and so act out one of the scenes in the story where they're so different to bring that to life in a different way. And finally, our fifth theme, relationships. How does Mr. Fogg change over time? A novel gives us a glimpse of a dynamic character. We can develop this character longer, as I said earlier, than we can in a short story.
So at the beginning of the book, we're given to believe that Mr. Fogg is this machine. And by the way, one of my favorite little tidbits is that he always takes the same number of steps every day to the reform fight. He's figured out the most efficient, you know, gait, and it's the same number of steps every day, back and forth. And so we're given to believe that he's somewhat of a machine. But by the end of the book, he's changed, and I won't tell you how all he's changed. But before his journey, he lived a solitary life, closed himself off to others, cared little about the way he was perceived by other people. But by the end of his trip, he recognizes the importance of human connections, both in the form of love and friendship and loyalty with Passepartout and other characters. So above all, this new understanding and appreciation is the greatest thing he has gained from this trip. And so the book is, in that way, a study of personality and how people can change. Can a cold, calculated, mechanical, reclusive old gentleman open his heart to love and relationship and allowing other people to help him or speak into his life, whereas he was very self-oriented at the beginning of the story? I'll just read a little bit on the relationship theme. "But what will become of you, Mr. Fogg?" "As for me, madame," replied the gentleman coldly, "I have need of nothing." "But how do you look upon the fate, sir, which awaits you?" "As I am in the habit of doing." "At least," said Aouda, "want should not overtake a man like you. Your friends?"
"I have no friends, madame."
"Your relatives?"
"I no longer have relatives."
"I pity you then, Mr. Fogg, for solitude is a sad thing, with no heart to which to confide your griefs. They say, though, that misery itself, shared by two sympathetic souls, may be borne with patience."
"They say so, madame."
"Mr. Fogg," said Aouda, rising and seizing his hand, "do you wish at once a kinswoman and a friend? Will you have me for your wife?"
Mr. Fogg, at this, rose in turn.
There was an unwonted light in his eyes, a slight trembling of the lips. Aouda looked into his face. The sincerity, rectitude, firmness, and sweetness of the soft glance of a noble woman who could dare all to save him to whom she owed all, at first astonished, then penetrated him. He shut his eyes for an instant, as if to avoid her look. When he opened them again, "I love you," he said, simply. "Ah," cried Aouda, pressing her hand to her heart. Passepartout was summoned and appeared immediately. Mr. Fogg still held Aouda's hand in his own. Passepartout understood, and his big round face became as radiant as the tropical sun at its zenith. And so he headed off to the parish, the servant, that is. So Mr. Fogg changed. And then at the very end of the book, "What's the matter, Passepartout?" I'll back up. "The next day, as soon as it was light, Passepartout rapped vigorously at his master's door. Mr. Fogg opened it and asked, 'What's the matter, Passepartout?'
'What is it, sir?' 'Why, I've just this instant found out—'"
"What?"
"'That we might have made the tour of the world in only 78 days.
"No doubt," returned Mr. Fogg, "by not crossing India. But if I had not crossed India, I should not have saved Aouda, and she would not have been my wife, and—" Mr. Fogg quietly shut the door. Phileas Fogg had won his wager and had made his journey around the world in 80 days. To do this, he had employed every means of conveyance: steamers, railways, carriages, yachts, trading vessels, sledges, elephants. The eccentric gentleman had throughout displayed all of his marvelous qualities of coolness and exactitude. But what then? What had he really gained by all this trouble? What had he brought back from this long and weary journey? Nothing, you say? Perhaps so. Nothing but a charming woman, who, strange as it may appear, made him the happiest of men. Truly, would you not for less than that make the tour around the world?" So, how has Fogg changed as a result of his journey? An excellent essay. So, finally, activity ideas. in addition to some that I mentioned, you, first of all, I'll say you can, novel units are becoming more common in the 21st century, I think, than they were, and so it is easy to Google information for Around the World in 80 Days or some other common novels. Some others that we use at our school, Rule of Thunder, Hear My Cry. How many of you are familiar with that book? Okay, good, set in the South, in racism. And then Amos Fortune, Adam of the Road, Island of Blue Dolphins, The Bronze Bow, Oliver Twist, Endurance by Shackleton, Cry the Beloved Country. These are all some that we use as study units. And teachers have either developed materials or for some common novels like this, you can buy materials from publishers that other teachers have developed, or like I said, Google things that you can sometimes use or purchase. I also want to say before I forget that I'm stressing imaginative stories today. That is the focus of the workshop, but we also in 7th and 8th grade do Hudson Taylor, George Washington Carver. There's also a value in doing biography, which I mentioned, Endurance by Shackleton, that would be more along that line as well. So there is a place to balance imaginative story as well. So some of these ideas, just to go over them quickly, but mostly I just have it here as a list that you can take home. So in a curriculum that you have published for you, maybe the students have worksheets and questions that are predetermined, and you read the story together and then you assign that. But if you pull a library book, or I call it a trade book, off the shelf that is published for general use, what do you do with the students? So here are some additional ideas that you could assign. I often use summary so that they have to paraphrase or write in their own words or analyze what happened in the chapter. It can be very short. In fact, this book in particular has, at the beginning of every chapter, it says, in which, and then a short statement, Passepartout takes a too great interest in his master and what comes of it. You would need a little bit more than that in a summary, but a summary should be short, forcing the students to say in their own words what happened in the chapter. So there's a value of summarizing. We talked about class discussion, enjoying reading orally with proper expression and feeling, tracing themes, role-playing characters. I mentioned that a bit, that could be done like between Passepartout and Fogg. Number 6, questions for a character and writing the answers. You could even act this out as a class then as well, but just having them assign, giving them an assignment to come up with some questions. If they could ask the character, what would they ask them? Discuss the character's motivations. Why do you think he's doing what he's doing? Number 8, I like to assign journal entries of a character. So after today, what did they write in their diary or their journey? So imagine what they're feeling after they experienced. You can do a little bit of diary summary, but hey, that was in the book. You should be writing journal of how they were feeling. Put yourself in their shoes. Comparing contrasting characters, I would have already mentioned. Identifying change, how they've grown. Reacting with your opinions or advice for the characters, good for 7th and 8th graders. Number 12, changing the story, whether it's the end of the book or just a chapter. What's an alternate ending to this chapter? So this chapter ended very exciting in this way, or could have ended in another way. It's always a fun thing to assign and then read them the next day. Bulletin boards, it could be research of the British Empire, it could be a map of his journey, something related to Around the World in 80 Days that the students could create and hang up on the wall. Have students prepare quizzes for each other. That could be more just what happened. It could be a test of, you know, did you read it for today? That makes them makes them become the teacher a little bit, right? It makes them know the story well enough to write a quiz, and then you know whether they read it. It helps with comprehension. Well, we're out of time, so I'll let the rest of the list there for you.
This recording and many others are available from Christian Learning Resource, the campus bookstore at Faith Builders. Order online at christianlearning.org or call 814-789-4769. Many Faith Builders recordings are also available on the Dock for Learning at thedockforlearning.org.